By the fire was a plate with half a round of cornbread and 2 pieces of fried pork. Inman took the food and put it in his haversack. There was an empty bedstead at the end of the room, away from the fire. The girl's bed, he reckoned. He went to it and threw the covers back and then stepped outside and stood looking at the dark-headed girl. In her pale dress she was just a swatch of light on the black ground. He lifted her and carried her inside and put her into the bed. He pulled off her shoes and covered her to her chin. Then he thought again and drew the covers down and turned her on her side, for he remembered that a boy of his regiment had passed out drunk on his back and would have smothered in his own spew had someone not taken note and kicked him over. This way she would live to wake in the morning with a pounding head, wondering how she came to be back in her own bed when the last she could remember was sporting in a hayloft with the preacher. At that moment the logs in the fireplace fell from the irons with a crash, shifting into a more favorable relation, and the fire brightened up. The girl's eyes opened, and she turned her head and stared straight at Inman. Her face was white in the firelight, her hair a turmoil. She seemed terrified, confused. Her mouth opened, as if to scream, but no sound came out. Inman leaned over and reached out his hand to her and touched her brow and brushed back the hair where it curled at the temples. "What's your name?" he said. "Laura," the woman said. "Listen to me, Laura," he said. "That preacher does not speak for God. No man does. Go back to sleep and wake up in the morning with me just a strong dream urging you to put him behind you. He means you no good. Set your mind on it." He touched her eyes with the tips of 2 fingers, as he had seen people do to the dead to close their lids against bad visions. She gentled down under his hand, settling back into sleep. Inman left her and walked back out to where the preacher stood tied to the tree. At that moment, the notion that he should take out his knife and cut the man up had much to recommend it, but instead Inman prowled in his knapsack and took out his pen and ink and paper. He found a place where moonlight came down through the trees. In its blue beam he wrote out the story in brief, putting little headwork and no fine touches to it, merely pressing down what he had learned of the near-killing into a paragraph. When he was done, he skewered the paper onto a tree branch at head level, just beyond the preacher's reach. The preacher watched him, and when he realized Inman's intent, he grew agitated and thrashed about as much as he could while fettered by the neck. He kicked at Inman with his feet, for he guessed at what he had written. He tried to grunt and squeal through the handkerchief wired to his mouth. "Testify, is that what you want?" Inman said. "Ah," the preacher said. Inman drew out the pistol and set it to the preacher's ear. He pulled back the hammer and flipped down the little lever that directed the firing pin to the lower shotgun barrel. "You speak one word above a whisper and you'll be lacking a head," Inman said. He untwisted the wire. The preacher spit out the handkerchief. "You've ruined my life," he said. "Don't lay that off on me," Inman said. "I wanted no part in this, but I don't want to have to wonder whether in a night or two you'll be back out in that black gorge with her slung over your horse again," Inman said. "Well, then shoot me. Just shoot me here and leave me hanging." "Don't think there's no charm in that offer." "God damn you to hell for what you're doing to me," the preacher said. Inman took the wet handkerchief from the ground and forced it into the preacher's mouth and rewired it and strode out. As he walked away, he heard fading grunts and moans, wordless hexes and curses. Inman walked hard the remainder of the night to put space between himself and that nameless place. When the morning at last lit up at his back like a yellow abscess, he had worked himself into rolling country, and he felt worn down to nothing. He had no idea where he was, nor did he know that he had accomplished but 12 miles in that long night of walking, for it felt like 100. He stopped and went into the woods and made a bed of ground litter. With his back against a tree he sat and ate the wedge of cornbread and the fatty pork he had taken from the woman's house. For much of the morning he lay on the ground and slept. Then he found himself awake, gazing at the blue sky through the pine boughs. He took out his pistol and wiped it with a rag and checked its loads, and kept it in his hand for company. What he had come to possess was a Lamaze, and the model Inman held was not one of the early and inferior Belgian models, but was stamped Birmingham along the barrel. He had picked it up off the ground and stuck it in his belt right before he took his wound outside Petersburg, and he had managed to hang on to it all through the mess of the field hospital and the train ride south to the capital in the boxcar filled with wounded. It was an oddly configured weapon, somewhat over-large and of curious proportion, but it was the fiercest sidearm in existence. Its cylinder was big as a fist and held 9 40-caliber rounds. But the dominant feature of it, and the thing that marked a strange new direction in pistol style, was this. The cylinder turned around a shotgun barrel, a crude and fat thing under the main barrel. Intended as a desperate last chance in close quarters, it fired a single load, either buckshot or a slug so big it would be like shooting leaden duck eggs at your foes. In the hand, despite its size, the Lamats felt balanced and solid and as of a piece as an ingot, and there was a certain amount of serenity associated with simply holding the stout pistol and thinking what it could do in your service. Inman rubbed at its cylinder and barrel and thought about the fight in the town and the river crossing and the preacher and how he might have done things differently in each case. He wished not to be smirched with the mess of other people. A part of him wanted to hide in the woods far from any road, be like an owl, move only at dark, or a ghost. Another part yearned to wear the big pistol openly on his hip and to travel by day under a black flag, respecting all who let him be, fighting all who would seek to fight him, letting rage be his guide against anything that ran counter to his will. Before the war, he had never been much of a one for strife. But once enlisted, fighting had come easy to him. He had decided it was like any other thing, a gift, like a man who could whittle birds out of wood, or one who could pick tunes from a banjo, or a preacher with the gift of words. You had little to do with it yourself. It was more a matter of how your nerves were strung toward quickness of hand and a steady head, so that you did not become witless and vague in battle, your judgment clouded in all kinds of ways, fatal and otherwise. That and having the size to prevail in the close stuff when it came down to a clinch. In the middle of the afternoon, Inman left his pine bower and tried to cover some distance. After only an hour, though, he found himself nearly bogged down with fatigue, every step a great effort. Up ahead he saw a pair of figures stopped in the road by a ford, but even from a distance it was clear they were slaves, and so he did not even bother slipping off into the woods to hide, but kept on walking. One man was trying to drive a red hog that had stopped to roll in the mud. The other carried an armload of bean poles. The drover kicked the hog to no effect, and then he took a pole from the load and struck and prodded the hog until it reluctantly struggled to its feet and waddled along. The men tipped their hats to Inman as they passed and said, "Day, Marse." Inman was so weak-feeling he wished momentarily that he were a big red hog and could just lie down and wallow until somebody took a beanpole to him. But he shucked off his boots and waded the ford, and then on the far bank he turned from the road and followed the river downstream, thinking to find a hidden place to cook a sparse meal of corn mush. But the wind shifted, and it carried the scent of real cooking from somewhere farther downriver. He followed the smell of meat in the air, snuffing his nose and blinking his eyes with his head cocked up like a bear. He soon arrived at a camp in a bend of the river, a wagon, a number of horses, pyramidal tents of gray canvas standing among a grove of birch trees. Inman squatted in the brush and watched the folk go about their camp craft. There were a jumble of people wearing about every tinge of skin there is. Inman guessed them to be as outlaw and Ishmaelite as himself. Show folk, outliers, a tribe of Irish gypsy horse traders all thrown in together. The horses were hobbled all around, and they grazed in the long grass under the trees. The stock varied from magnificent to near dead. Backlit by the gold light of afternoon, though, they all looked beautiful to Inman. The grace and the deep curve of their downturned necks, the frail cannon bones so evident through the thin skin above their fetlocks. Inman guessed the traders were hiding them out. So many horses had been killed in the fighting that they were becoming scarce. Prices had swelled beyond belief. But the army had men out rounding up horses, paying nearly nothing for them. A part of Inman wished he had the money to buy a big long-strided gelding, mount up and canter off and end his life as a footman. But he had not that much money. And, too, it is hard to be stealthy when accompanied by a horse. It's a big thing to hide, and uncooperative. So Inman let that dream pass. Thinking he might find some feeling of kinship with the outcasts, Inman entered the camp holding his empty hands out to his side. The gypsies took him in with apparent generosity, though he knew they would steal the boots off his feet if they could find advantage to do so. They had an iron pot of dark stew going over a small fire, rabbit, squirrel, a stolen chicken, various pilfered vegetables, chiefly cabbage. chunks of pumpkin drizzled in molasses roasted over coals in a Dutch oven. A woman in a bright skirt of cloth scraps pieced together like a quilt spooned him up food onto his plate and went about frying corn fritters in a pan of lard. The batter popped like distant battle fire when she spooned the grease. Inman propped against a tree and ate, looking about him at the riffle of water on stones in the river, the yellow leaves of an early-turning birch trembling bright in the stir of air, the light falling in beams through the smoke of campfires. A man sitting on a log scratched out jigs and reels from a cigar-box fiddle. Children played in the shallow water at the river's edge. Other gypsies worked at the horses. A boy brushed an old mare with a corn cob dipped in a bucket of potash and soot to cover her gray hair, and then took a rat-tail file and worked on her teeth. She shed years right before Inman's eyes. A woman snubbed a big bay up to a birch trunk and then twitched it and poured lamp oil on the frog of its hoof and lit fire to it to curb a tendency to lameness. All through the herd, spavins and bots and heaves to be treated or disguised. Inman had dealt with gypsies before and thought them possessed of a fine honesty in their predatory relationship to the rest of mankind, their bald admission of constantly seeking an opening. But they were benign-seeming in this quiet bend of the river. It was no concern of theirs how the war concluded. Whichever side won, people would still need horses. The contest was no more to them than a temporary hindrance to business. Inman stayed with the gypsies through the remainder of the day. He took a dip from the stew pot whenever he became hungry. He slept some and listened to the fiddler and watched a woman telling fortunes by reading the pattern of leaves in a cup of herb tea. But he declined her offer to tell his own future, for he figured he already had all the discouragement he needed. Later in the afternoon he watched a dark-haired woman walk among the horses and put a bridle on a dun mare. She was young and wore a man's sweater over a long black skirt and was about as pretty as women get to be. Something in the darkness of her hair or the way she moved or the thinness of her fingers reminded him momentarily of Ada. He sat and stared as she caught up the hems of her long skirt and petticoat and clenched them in her teeth before mounting astride the mare. Her white legs were exposed to the thigh. She rode down the river bank and crossed at a place deep enough that in the middle the horse lost its footing and swam a stroke or two. It struggled, climbing up the far bank, working hard with its haunches. Water streamed off its back and sides, and the woman was wet to the hips. She leaned forward for balance, with her face almost resting on the horse's neck. Her hair fell against its black mane, so that she could not tell one from the other. When they reached level ground, she put her heels to the mare's side, and they galloped away through the open woods. It was to Inman a stirring sight, a happy vision that he was grateful to have been granted. On toward dusk, some little gypsy boys whittled gigs from river birch limbs and went to a backwater and gigged frogs until they had a basketful. They cut their legs off and strung them on sticks to roast over a fire of hickory coals. While the frog meat was cooking, a man came to Inman with a bottle of Moet he claimed he had taken in trade. The man was not entirely sure what it was that he had, but he knew he wished to sell it for top dollar. So Inman counted out some money and composed himself a plate of supper from the frog legs and a part of the wine. He found the two not ill-sorted, but when he was done they did not make a real dinner for someone as hungry as he was. He wandered about the camp looking for other food and eventually made his way to the wagon of show folk, a medicine show. A white man came from where he sat near their tent and talked to Inman and queried him as to his business. The man was thin and tall and had some age on him, for the skin under his eyes was pale and pouched and he wore blacking in his hair. He seemed to run the place. Inman asked if he could buy a meal and the man said he reckoned so, but that they would not eat until much later, for they had to practice their act while there was yet light. Inman was welcome to sit and watch. In a minute, the dark-haired woman he had seen earlier came out of the tent. Inman could not take his eyes off her. He studied her bearing beside the man, trying to guess the forces running between them. He first guessed them to be married, and then he guessed not. The two set up a backstop, and the woman stood against it, and the man threw knives at her, so that the blades just missed her and fetched up shivering in the boards. That seemed to Inman plenty to draw a crowd, but they had as well a big gray-bearded Ethiopian, who had a regal bearing and dressed in purple robes, and was portrayed to have been in his youth the king of Africa. He played a banjo-like thing and could just about make a dead man dance, though his instrument was made of but a gourd and had just one string. As well, the troop included a little menagerie of Indians of several makes, a Seminole from Florida, a Creek, a Cherokee from Echota, and a Yemisi woman. Their part in shows was to tell jokes and beat drums and dance and chant. The wagon they traveled in was loaded with fancy little colored bottles of medicine, each with its special disease to cure. Cancer, consumption, neuralgia, malaria, cachexia, stroke, fit, and seizure. After dark, they asked Inman to join them for dinner, and they all sat on the ground by the fire and ate great bloody beefsteaks and potatoes pan-fried in bacon drippings and wild greens dressed with what drippings the potatoes had not soaked up. The Ethiopian and the Indians joined in the meal as if they were all of a color and equals. They took their turns speaking, and permission to talk was neither sought nor given. When done, they went and squatted by the water, each scouring his own plate in river sand. Then the white man threw sticks on the coals of the cook fire, building it up with no eye toward thrift of wood, until flame stood shoulder high. The show folk passed a bottle around and sat telling Inman stories of their endless travels. The road, they said, was a place apart, a country of its own, ruled by no government but natural law, and its one characteristic was freedom. Their stories were of being broke and of sudden windfalls, card games and horse auctions, and the wonderful prevalence of the witless. Various tight spots with the law, disasters narrowly averted, fools bested in trade, wise men met on the road and their often contradictory wisdom, townships of gullibility and of particular viciousness. They reminded each other of certain camp places and of meals eaten in them, and they reached consensus that the finest of all was a place some years in the past where a river of considerable size poured directly from the base of a rock face, and they likewise agreed that they had never eaten better fried chicken than they had cooked in the shadow of that cliff. After a while, Inman could attend to little but how beautiful the woman looked in the firelight, the way it lit up her hair and the fineness of her skin. And then at some point the white man said a strange thing. He said some day the world might be ordered so that when a man uses the term slave, it be only metaphoric. Sometime deep in the night, Inman took his pack sacks and went into the woods beyond camp and spread his bedding within earshot of the gypsy music and the sound of voices. He tried to sleep, but he just tossed about on the ground. He lit a candle stub and poured the remainder of the wine into his tin cup and took his Bartram scroll from his knapsack. He opened the book at random and read and reread the sentence that first fell under his eye. It concerned itself with an unnamed plant, similar as best he could tell to a rhododendron. This shrub grows in copses or little groves in open, high situations, where trees of large growth are but scatteringly planted. Many simple stems arise together from a root or source erect, 4, 5, and 6 feet high. Their limbs or branches, which are produced toward the top of the stems, also stand nearly erect, lightly diverging from the main stems, which are furnished with moderately large, ovate, pointed, entire leaves of a pale or yellowish-green color. These leaves are of a firm, compact texture, both surfaces smooth and shining, and stand nearly erect upon short petals. The branches terminate with long, loose panicles of spikes of white flowers, whose segments are 5, long, and narrow. Inman occupied himself pleasurably for quite some time with this long sentence. First he read it until each word rested in his head with a specific weight peculiar to itself, for if he did not, his attention just skittered over phrases so they left no marks. That accomplished, he fixed in his mind the setting, supplying all the missing details of a high open forest, the kinds of trees that would grow there, the birds that would frequent their limbs, the bracken that would grow under them. When he could hold that picture firm and clear, he began constructing the shrub in his mind, forming all its particulars, until it arose in his thinking as vivid as he could make it, though it in no way matched any known plant, and was in several features quite fantastic. He blew out his candle and wrapped himself in his bedding and sipped at the last of his wine in preparation for sleep. But his mind turned on the dark-haired woman, and on the woman named Laura, and the softness of her thigh-backs against his arms as he carried her. And then he thought of Ada and of Christmas 4 years ago, for there had been champagne then, too. He leaned his head back against the tree bark and took a long draught of wine and remembered with some particularity the feel of Ada sitting on his lap in the stove corner. It seemed like another life, another world. He remembered her weight on his legs, the softness of her, and yet the hard angularity of her bones underneath. She had leaned back and rested her head on his shoulder, and her hair smelled of lavender and of herself. Then she sat up, and he put his hands to the points of her shoulders and felt the underlayment of muscle and the knobby shoulder joints beneath the skin. He pulled her back to him and wanted to wrap his arms around her and hold her tight, but she blew out air through her pressed lips and stood and pulled at the wrinkles in the skirt of her dress and reached up to smooth back little rings of hair that had sprung loose at her temples. She turned and looked down at him. "Well," she had said, "well." Inman had leaned forward, taking her hand, and rubbed across its back with his thumb. The fine bones running to the wrist from the knuckles moved beneath the pressure like piano keys. Then he turned her hand over and smoothed back the fingers when she tried to draw them in and make a fist. He put his lips to her wrist where the slate-blue veins twined, and Ada slowly drew her hand away and then stood looking down absently at its palm. "There's not tidings written on it. Not any we can read," Inman said. Ada had put her hand down and said that was unexpected. Then she walked away. When Inman finally let go the memory and slept, he dreamed a dream as bright as the real day. In it, he lay as he did in the ordinary world, in a forest of hardwoods, their boughs visibly tired from a summer of growing, and just weeks away from the color and the fall. Mixed in among the trees were the shrubs he had imagined from his reading of Bartram. They were covered in great hallucinatory blossoms, pentangular in form. In the dream world, fine rain sifted down through the heavy leaves and moved along the ground in curtains so sheer that it did not even wet him through his clothes. Ada appeared among the tree trunks and moved at about the pace of the rain toward him. She wore a white dress and was wound about the shoulders and head in a wrapping of black cloth, but he knew her from her eyes and from the way she walked. He rose from where he lay on the ground, and though perplexed as to how she came to be there, he longed to hold her, and went to do it, but three times as he reached his arms to her she fogged through them, vague and flickery and gray. The fourth time, though, she stood firm and substantial, and he held her tight. He said, "I've been coming for you on a hard road. I'm never letting you go, never." She looked at him and took the wrapping from about her head and seemed in the look of her face to agree, though she said not a word. Inman was roused from sleep by the song of morning birds. The vision of Ada would not loose its grip on his mind, nor did he wish it to. He arose, and there was a heavy dew on the grass, and the sun already stood at the treetops. He walked through the woods to the camp, but everyone was gone. The fire where the medicine wagon had been was dead. There was nothing to say the show folk had been real but the big black fire ring and a set of parallel lines cut in the dirt by their wagon wheels. Inman was sorry not to have bid them farewell, but he walked all through the day, with some brightening of his spirit from the clear dream he had been awarded in the dark of night. Ashes of Roses. One warm afternoon, at the brink of fall, Ruby and Ada worked in the lower field, which Ruby had designated as the winter garden. It was the sort of day when Joe Pieweed had grown 7 feet tall, and its autumnal metallic flower head suddenly opened and glittered in the sun, looking for all the world like frost early of a morning. They served as reminders of just how rapidly the first real frost was approaching, even though the sun was still hot and the cow still spent the day following the shade of the big hickory tree as it moved across the lower pasture. Ada and Ruby hoed and pulled weeds among the rows of young cabbages and turnips, collards and onions, the kind of coarse food they would mostly live on for the winter. Some weeks earlier they had prepared the garden carefully, plowing and sweetening the dirt with fireplace ashes and manure from the barn, and then harrowing the cloddy ground, Ruby driving the horse, while Ada rode the drag to add weight. The harrow was a crude device knocked together by one of the blacks from a fork in an oak trunk. Holes had been augured through the green wood of the two spreading ends of the trunk, and fitted with long spikes of cured black locust. As the oak dried, it had tightened hard around the sharpened locust and needed no further attachment. During the work, Ada had sat at the fork, braced with hands and feet as the harrow jounced across the ground, breaking up clumps of plowed dirt and combing it smooth with the tines of locust. She had watched the turned ground passing, and had snatched up 3 partial arrowheads, and a flint scraper, and 1 fine, complete bird point. When they began planting, Ruby had held out a handful of tiny black seeds. "Looks like not much," she said. "It takes faith to jump from this to a root cellar filled with turnips some many weeks hence. That in a warm fall, for we started late." The crops were growing well, largely, Ruby claimed, because they had been planted, at her insistence, in strict accordance with the signs. In Ruby's mind, everything, setting fence posts, making sauerkraut, killing hogs, fell under the rule of the heavens. "Cut firewood in the old of the moon," she'd advised, "otherwise it won't do much but fry and hiss at you come winter. Next April, when the poplar leaves are about the size of a squirrel's ear, we'll plant corn when the signs are in the feet. Otherwise, the corn will just shank and hang down. November, we'll kill a hog in the growing of the moon, for if we don't, the meat will lack grease and pork chops will cup up in the pan." Monroe would have dismissed such beliefs as superstition, folklore. But Ada, increasingly covetous of Ruby's learning and the ways living things inhabited this particular place, chose to view the signs as metaphoric. They were, as Ada saw them, an expression of stewardship, a means of taking care, a discipline. They provided a ritual of concern for the patterns and tendencies of the material world, where it might be seen to intersect with some other world. Ultimately, she decided, the signs were a way of being alert, and under those terms she could honor them. They worked among the plants for some time that afternoon, and then they heard the sound of wheels, a horse, a metal pail banging against a sideboard with a ring that filled the cove. A pair of ancient mules, and then a wagon, rounded the curve of the road and stopped by the fence. The wagon bed was piled full with satchels and boxes, to such extent that the people all walked. Ada and Ruby went to the fence and found the group to be made of pilgrims from Tennessee on their way to South Carolina. They had taken a number of wrong turnings along the river, had missed the way to Wagon Road Gap, and were now fetched up at this dead end. The party was composed of 3 broken women and a half-dozen young children. They were tended by a pair of kind slaves, a man and wife, who hovered about the women as close as shadows, even though they might just as easily have cut every throat in the family any night as they slept. The women said their husbands were off at the fighting, and they were fleeing the Federals in Tennessee, aiming for Camden in South Carolina, where one of the women had a sister. They asked leave to sleep in the hayloft, and while they were making up their nests in the hay, Ada and Ruby went to work cooking. Ruby cut the heads off 3 chickens, for the yard was now so full of chicks they could hardly walk to the spring house without stepping on one, and the population was such that they could anticipate a sufficiency of capons soon. They cut the chickens up and fried them, cooked pole beans, boiled potatoes, stewed squash. Ruby made a triple recipe of biscuits, and when supper was ready, they called in the visitors and sat them at the dining room table. The slaves had the same fare, but ate out under the pear tree. The travelers dined hard for quite some time, and when they were done eating, there were but 2 wings and a thigh left on the chicken platter, and they had gone through more than a pound of butter and a pint pitcher of sorghum. One woman said, "My, that was good. It's been 2 weeks now that we've had little to eat but dry cornbread without butter or bacon drippings or molasses to wetten it up a little. Chokey food." "How do you come to be on the road?" Ada said. "The Federals rode down on us and robbed even the niggers," the woman said. "They took every bit of food we had been able to raise this year. I even saw one man filling his coat pockets with our lard, dipping it by the handful. Then we were teetotally stripped and searched right down to our very persons by a Federal we were told was a woman in uniform, but it was not. It had an Adam's apple. It took from us every article of jewelry we had hidden. Then they burnt our house down in the rain and rode away. Shortly it was only a chimney standing sentry over a cellar hole full of bitter-smelling black water. We had nothing, but we stayed a while, from lack of will to part from home. On the 3rd day I stood with my least little girl looking down into that hole, where was the wreckage of everything we had. She picked up a shard of broken dinner plate and said, 'Mama, I expect we'll soon be eating off leaves.' Then it was that I knew we had to go." "That is the way of the Federals," another of the women said. "They've come up with a fresh idea in warfare, make the women and children atone for the deaths of soldiers." "This is a time that carves the heart down to a bitter nub," the 3rd woman said. You are luckier than you know, hid in this cove. Ada and Ruby saw the travelers off to bed, and the next morning they cooked nearly all the eggs they had and made a pot of grits and more biscuits. After breakfast, they drew a map of the way to the gap and set them on the next leg of their journey. That noon, Ruby said she wanted to walk up and check on the apple orchard, so Ada suggested they have their lunch there. They made a picnic of the leftover pieces of last night's fried chicken, a small bowl of potato salad, for which Ruby had whipped up the mayonnaise, and some vinegared cucumber slices. They carried the dinner up to the apple orchard in a wooden bucket and ate it under the trees on a quilt spread in the grass. It was an afternoon of bright haze, the sunlight sourceless and uniform. Ruby examined the trees and judged solemnly that the apples were making tolerably well. Then out of the blue she looked at Ada and said, "Point north." She grinned at the long delay as Ada worked out the cardinal directions from her recollection of where the sun set. Such questions were a recent habit Ruby had developed. She seemed to delight in demonstrating how disoriented Ada was in the world. As they walked by the creek one day, she had asked, "What's the course of that water? Where does it come from, and what does it run into?" Another day she had said, "Name me 4 plants on that hillside that in a pinch you could eat." How many days to the next new moon? Name 2 things blooming now and 2 things fruiting. Ada did not yet have those answers, but she could feel them coming, and Ruby was her principal text. During the daily rounds of work, Ada had soon noted that Ruby's lore included many impracticalities beyond the raising of crops. The names of useless beings, both animal and vegetable, and the custom of their lives apparently occupied much of Ruby's thinking, for she was constantly pointing out the little creatures that occupy the nooks of the world. Her mind marked every mantis in a stand of ragweed, the corn borers in the little tents they folded out of milkweed leaves, striped and spotted salamanders with their friendly smiling faces under rocks in the creek. Ruby noted little hairy, liverish, poisonous-looking plants, and fungi growing on the damp bark of dying trees, all the larvae and bugs and worms that live alone inside a case of sticks or grit or leaves. Each life with a story behind it. Every little gesture nature made to suggest a mind marking its life as its own caught Ruby's interest. So as they sat on the blanket, drowsy and full from lunch, Ada told Ruby that she envied her knowledge of how the world runs. Farming, cookery, wild lore. "How do you come to know such things?" Ada had asked. Ruby said she had learned what little she knew in the usual way. A lot of it was grandmother knowledge, got from walking around the settlement talking to any old woman who would talk back, watching them work and asking questions. Some came from helping Sally Swanger, who knew, Ruby claimed, a great many quiet things, such as the names of all plants down to the plainest weed. Partly, though, she claimed she had just puzzled out in her own mind how the world's logic works. It was mostly a matter of being attentive. "You commence by trying to see what likes what," Ruby said, which Ada interpreted to mean observe and understand the workings of affinity in nature. Ruby pointed to red splashes of color on the green hillside of the ridge, sumac and dogwood already turning color in advance of other trees. "Why would they do that near a month ahead?" she said. "Chance," Ada said. Ruby made a little sound like spitting a fleck of dirt or a gnat from the tip of her tongue. Her view was that people like to lay off anything they can't fathom as random. She saw it another way. Both sumac and dogwood were full of ripe berries at that time of year. The thing a person had to ask was, what else is happening that might bear on the subject? One thing was birds moving. They were passing over all day long and all night, too. You didn't have to but look up to know that. Enough to make you dizzy at the numbers of them. Then think about standing on a high place like the jump-off rock and looking down on the trees as the birds see them. Then wonder at how green and alike the trees look, one very much resembling another, whether it offers a meal or not. That's all roving birds see. They don't know these woods. They don't know where a particular food tree might live. Ruby's conclusion was, dogwood and sumac maybe turn red to say eat to hungry stranger birds. Ada said, "You seem to suppose that a dogwood might have a plan in this." "Well, maybe they do," Ruby said. She asked whether Ada had ever looked close up at the particular mess of various birds, They're droppings. Hardly, Ada said. Well, don't act so proud about it, Ruby said. In her view, that's where the answer to this issue might lie. Every little dogwood can't grow up right where it falls under the big dogwood. Being rooted, they use the birds to move themselves around to more likely ground. Birds eat berries, and the seeds come through whole and unmarred, ready to grow where dropped, already dressed with manure. It was Ruby's opinion that if a person puzzled all this out over time, she might also find a lesson somewhere in it, for much of creation worked by such method and to such ends. They sat quietly for a while, and then in the warm, still air of the afternoon, Ruby lay down and dozed on the quilt. Ada was tired, too, but she fought off sleep like a child at bedtime. She rose and walked beyond the orchard to the margin of the woods where the tall autumn flowers, goldenrod and ironweed and Joe Pieweed, were beginning to bloom yellow and indigo and iron gray. Monarchs and swallowtails worked among the flower heads. Three finches balanced on blackberry canes, the leaves already turned maroon, and then flew away, flaring out low to the ground, their yellow backs flashing between their black wings until they disappeared into a clump of dog hobble and sumac at the transition between fields and woods. Ada stood still and let her eyes go unfocused, and as she did, she became aware of the busy movements of myriad tiny creatures, vibrating all through the massed flowers, down the stems and clear to the ground, insects flying, crawling, climbing, eating. Their accumulation of energy was a kind of luminous quiver of life that filled Ada's undirected vision right to the edges. She stood there, part in a lethargic daze, part watchful, thinking of what the pilgrim woman had said about Ada's great luck. On such a day as this, despite the looming war and all the work she knew the cove required of her, she could not see how she could improve her world. It seemed so fine she doubted it could be done. That evening, after dinner, Ruby and Ada sat on the porch, Ada reading aloud. They were nearly done with Homer. Ruby had grown impatient with Penelope, but she would sit of a long evening and laugh at the tribulations of Odysseus, all the stones the gods threw in his passway. She held the suspicion, though, that there was more of Stobrod in Odysseus than old Homer was willing to let on, and she found his alibis for stretching out his trip to be suspect in the extreme, an opinion only confirmed by the current passage in which the characters were denned up in a swineherd's hut drinking and telling tales. She concluded that all in all not much had altered in the way of things, despite the passage of a great volume of time. When the light began to give out, Ada put down the book. She sat and examined the sky. Something about the color of the light or the smell of night coming on brought to mind a party she had attended on her last trip back to Charleston shortly before Sumter, and she recounted it to Ruby. It was held at her cousin's house, a grand place situated on a broad bend of the Wando River, and it lasted for 3 days. For the duration, they all slept only from dawn to noon, and lived on little but oysters and champagne and pastry. Each evening there was music and dancing, and then late in the nights, under a moon growing to full, they went out on the slow water in rowing boats. It was a strange time of war fever, and even young men previously considered dull and charmless suddenly acquired an aura of glamour shimmering about them, for they all suspected that shortly many of them would be dead. During those brief days and nights, any man that wished might become somebody's darling. On the party's final night, Ada had worn a dress of mauve silk, trimmed in lace dyed to match. It was cut close in the waist to suit her slimness. Monroe had bought the entire bolt of cloth from which the dress was made so that no one else might wear that color. He remarked that it set off her dark hair perfectly and gave her an air of mystery among the more common pinks and pale blues and yellows. That night, a Savannah man, the dashing-looking but largely witless second son of a wealthy indigo merchant, flirted so tirelessly with Ada that finally she agreed to go out on the river with him, though what little she knew of him inclined her to believe he was only a vain fool. The man's name was Blunt. He rowed to the middle of the Wando and drifted. They sat facing each other, Ada with the mauve dress drawn tight around her legs to keep its hem from the tar that caulked the boat's bottom. Neither of them spoke. Blunt feathered the oars over and over, letting the water drip from them into the river. He seemed to have something on his mind that accorded well with the sound of the water running off the oars, for he kept on doing it until Ada told him to stop. Blunt had brought a pair of flutes and a partial bottle of champagne still cool enough to sweat in the heavy air. He offered Ada a glass, but she declined her portion, so he finished off the bottle and threw it out into the river. The water lay so still that the circles from the splash expanded on and on until they became too distant to see. Music from the house carried across the water, too faint to identify more precisely than that it was a waltz. In the darkness, the low shoreline seemed impossibly far. The normal qualities of the landscape were altered beyond recognition, distilled to strange minimal parts, simple as geometry, planes and circles and lines. The full moon stood directly overhead, its disk softened by the humidity in the air. The sky glimmered silver, too bright for stars. The wide river was silver as well, only slightly duller. Morning mist already rose from the water, though the dawn was hours away. The only demarcation between river and sky was the line of dark trees at either horizon. Blunt finally spoke out. He talked a while about himself. He had recently graduated from the university in Columbia, and had just begun learning the Charleston portion of the family business. But, of course, he would immediately enlist should war begin, as everyone expected it soon would. He talked with bravado about driving back any force bent on subjugating the southern states. Ada had heard like sentiments repeated over and over throughout the party and was tired of them. As Blunt continued, though, he apparently became as unconvinced as Ada, for eventually he bogged down in his war talk and fell silent. He stared down into the black bottom of the boat so that Ada could see only the top of his head. Then, under the influence of drink and the strangeness of the night, Blunt admitted he was terrified of the fighting that almost certainly lay before him. He was unsure if he would be able to acquit himself in a way that would bring credit. But neither could he see any course of escape that would not be shameful. Further, he had been visited by recurring dreams of horrible death in many forms. One of them, he was certain, would someday claim him. He had talked looking down, as if addressing his shoe tops, but when he angled his pale face up into the moonlight, Ada noted the shining paths of tears running down his cheeks. She realized with an unexpected flush of tenderness that Blunt was no warrior, but had instead the heart of a shopkeeper. She reached forward and touched his hand where it rested on his knee. She knew that the proper thing to say was that duty and honor demanded brave action in defense of homeland. Women had been uttering like phrases all through the party, but Ada found her throat closed against the words. Lacking them, she could have used a simpler locution, telling him only, "Don't worry," or "Be brave." But any such comforting formula seemed at that moment unutterably false to her, so she said nothing and only continued to stroke the back of his hand. She hoped Blunt would not think her token of kindness more than it was, since her first impulse, when pressed upon by men, was to draw up and back off, and the rowing boat left little room for retreat. As they drifted along, though, she was relieved to see that Blunt was too overwhelmed by fear of the future to think of courting. They sat that way for some time until they drifted to the bend of the river. The boat headed straight for the outside of the curve, threatening to ground itself on a sandy bank that shone out as a strip of paleness in the moonlight. Blunt composed himself again, and took the oars, and returned him upstream to the landing. He walked her to the porch of the brightly lighted house, the interior ablaze with argon lamps. The silhouettes of dancers passed across the yellow windows, and now the music was distinct enough to identify, first Gungle, then Strauss. Blunt stopped at the doorway. He put the ends of two fingers to Ada's chin, and tipped her face up, and leaned forward to kiss her cheek. It was but a brief and brotherly press of lips. Then he walked away. Ada now remembered that as she had walked through the house to go upstairs to her room, she had been struck by the figure of a woman's back in a mirror. She stopped and looked. The dress the figure wore was the color called ashes of roses, and Ada stood, held in place by a sharp stitch of envy for the woman's dress, and the fine shape of her back, and her thick dark hair, and the sense of assurance she seemed to evidence in her very posture. Then Ada took a step forward, and the other woman did too, and Ada realized that it was herself she was admiring, the mirror having caught the reflection of an opposite mirror on the wall behind her, The light of the lamps and the tint of the mirrors had conspired to shift colors, bleaching mauve to rose. She climbed the steps to her room and prepared for bed, but she slept poorly that night, for the music went on until dawn. As she lay awake, she thought how odd it had felt to win her own endorsement. The next day, as the partiers were loading into carriages to be taken back into the city, Ada unexpectedly met Blunt on the front steps. He could not meet her eye, and he barely spoke, so put out of countenance was he by his performance the night before. Ada thought it to his credit, though, that he had not asked her to keep what had happened secret. She had never seen him again, but in a letter from her cousin Lucy, Ada learned that Blunt had died at Gettysburg, shot, according to all reports, in the face, during the retreat from Cemetery Ridge. He had been walking backward, not wishing to be shot in the back. At the tale's conclusion, Ruby was not much impressed with Blunt's effort toward honor, and could only marvel at lives so useless that they required missing sleep and paddling about on a river for pleasure. "You've missed my point," Ada said. They sat for a while, watching the light fall away and the details go from the trees on the ridges. Then Ruby rose and said, "Time for my night work." It was her habitual way of saying good night. She went off to take a last look at the animals, check the doors on the outbuildings, bank the fire and the kitchen stove. Meanwhile, the book still in her lap, Ada remained on the porch, looking out across the yard and down to the barn, on past the fields to the wooded slopes, up to the darkening sky. The colors that had reminded her of Charleston were now muted, everything declining toward stillness. Her thoughts, though, seemed intent on folding back on themselves, for she recalled that she and Monroe had sat thusly on a night just after moving to the cove. These now familiar elements of landscape had seemed strange to them both. This mountain country was so dark and inclined to the vertical compared with Charleston. Monroe had commented that, like all elements of nature, the features of this magnificent topography were simply tokens of some other world, some deeper life, with a whole other existence, toward which we ought aim all our yearning. And Ada had then agreed. But now, as she looked out at the view, she held the opinion that what she saw was no token, but was all the life there is. It was a position in most ways contrary to Monroe's. Nevertheless, it did not rule out its own denomination of sharp yearning, though Ada could not entirely set a name to its direction. Ruby crossed the yard and paused at the gate. She said, "The cow needs putting away." Then, without further salute, she went on up the road toward the cabin. Ada left the porch and walked down past the barn into the pasture. The sun was long gone below the ridgelines, the light falling fast. The mountain stood gray in the dusk, as pale and insubstantial as breath blown on glass. The place seemed inhabited by a great force of loneliness. Even the old-timers talked of the weight that bears down on a person alone in the mountains at that time of day, worse even than full dark on a moonless night, for it is at twilight that the threat of dark makes itself felt most strongly. Ada had sensed that power from the beginning and complained of it. She remembered Monroe had tried to reason that the isolate feeling did not arise from this particular ground, as she claimed. It was nothing unique to her or to the place, but was an element of common life. Only a very simple or a very hard mind might not feel it, in the way that some rare constitutions are insensitive to heat or cold. And as with most things, Monroe had an explanation. He said that in their hearts people feel that long ago God was everywhere, all the time. The sense of loneliness is what fills the vacuum when he pulls back one degree more remote. The air was chill, dew was in the grass already, and Ada was damp at the hem by the time she got to Waldo, who was lying in the tall grass along the lower fence row. The cow roused up, stiff in her hip joints, and started to the gate. Ada stepped into the oblong of grass Waldo had flattened. She felt the cow's heat rise from the ground around her legs, and she wanted to lie down there and rest, suddenly, unaccountably tired, as from an accumulation of the month's work. Instead, she stooped momentarily and worked her hands under the grass and into the dirt that still felt warm as a living thing from the heat of the day and the body of the cow. An owl hooted from the trees beyond the creek. Ada counted off the rhythm of the 5-beat phrase as if scanning a line of poetry. a long, two shorts, two longs. Death bird, people said of the owl, though Ada could see no reason why. The call was so soft and lovely in the slaty light, like a dove's cry, but with more substance to it. Waldo bawled at the gate, impatient, needing, as so much did in the cove, the things Ada was learning to do. So she took her hands from the ground and stood. Exile and Brute Wandering. Inman walked through days of cooling weather, blue skies, and empty roads. His course was necessarily waggling as he sought to avoid pikes and towns, but the way he found through deep country and widely spaced farms seemed safe enough. He met few people, and those mainly slaves. The nights were warm and lit by big moons growing to full and then achieving it, then falling away. There were often hayricks to sleep in, so that he could lie back and look at the moon and stars, and he could fancy for a time that he was a footloose vagabond with not a thing to fear in all creation. The days blended uneventfully together, though he tried to mark something down in his mind from each of them. One day he remembered only as being composed of hard course setting. There were many road turnings, all of them unmarked by signpost or blaze, so that he had to ask the way over and over. He first came to a house built right in the crotch of two roads, so close that the porch nearly blocked the passway. A tired-looking woman rested spraddle-legged in a straight chair. She chewed on her lower lip, and her eyes seemed focused on some great and indefinite event at the horizon. Where her skirt dipped at her lap was a pool of shadow. "Is this the way to Salisbury?" Inman said. The woman sat with her knotty hands and fists on her knees. Intent, apparently, on exercising thrift in gestures, she barely tipped the right thumb in response. It might have been no more than a nervous tick. Not another feature ever moved, but Inman proceeded in the direction suggested. Later he came on a gray-headed man sitting in the shade of a sweet-gum tree. The man wore a fine vest of yellow silk with no shirt under it, and it was unbuttoned and lay open so that his old dugs hung down like those on a sow hog. His legs stuck out straight before him, and he slapped one thigh open-handed, as if it were a beloved but misbehaving dog. When he talked, his speech seemed cramped to nothing but vowels. "Is this the turning to Salisbury?" Inman said. "E," the man said. "Salisbury," Inman says. "This the way." "Ah," the man said, with finality. Inman went on. Still later he came to a man in a field pulling onions. "Salisbury?" Inman said. The man spoke not a word, but stretched out an arm and pointed the way with an onion. All Inman remembered of another day's march was the white sky, and that sometime during it a crow had died in flight, falling with a puff of dust into the road before him, its black beak open and its gray tongue out as if to taste the dirt. And that later he came upon three farm girls in pale cotton dresses, dancing barefoot in the dust of the road. They stopped when they saw him coming and climbed a fence, and sat on the top rail, with their heels hooked on the second rail and their rusty knees up under their chins. They watched him as he walked by but would not speak when he threw up a hand and said hey. One morning at the end of this time, Inman found himself walking through a wood of young poplar, their leaves already turning to yellow, though the season did not yet call for it. His thinking turned on issues of food. He had been making fair time, but had grown tired of skulking and starving, and living off of nothing but corn mush and apples and persimmons and stolen melons. He was thinking how much he would relish some meat and bread. He was weighing that desire against the calculation of the risk he would have to take to get them, when he came upon a group of women at a river doing laundry. He stepped into an edge of forest and watched. The women stood out in water to their calves, slapping the clothes against smooth stones and rinsing and wringing them, then draping them over nearby bushes to dry. Some talked and laughed, and others hummed snatches of song. They had their skirt-tails caught up between their legs and tucked into their waistbands to keep them from the water. To Inman they looked like they were wearing the Oriental pantaloons of the Zouave regiments, whose soldiers looked so strangely bright and festive scattered dead across a battlefield. The women, not knowing they were being watched, had their skirts hiked up high onto their thighs, and the water running from the clothes sheeted off the pale skin and glistened in the light like oil. On some other day this would have had its appeal, but Inman's attention rested on the fact that the women had brought their dinners, some in withy baskets and some tied up in cloths. They had left them sitting on the river bank. He first thought to call out and ask to buy something to eat from them, but he suspected that they would immediately form ranks and take up rocks from the river bottom and drive him away, so he decided to stay hidden. He worked his way down among the trees and boulders to the river bank. After sneaking out a hand from behind the shaggy trunk of a big river birch to heft several of the dinners, he took the heaviest one, leaving much more than fair money in its place, for it seemed especially important at that moment to be generous. He walked off down the road, swinging the cloth bundle by one of its loose ends, and when he put some distance between himself and the river, he opened the knotted cloth and found three large chunks of poached fish, three boiled potatoes, and a pair of underdone biscuits. Biscuits with fish, Inman thought, what unseemly cookery, and what a pale meal it made, especially when matched up against the brown feast he had imagined. He ate it anyway, lunching afoot. A short time later, traveling down a deserted stretch of road, the last of the potatoes 2 bites from gone, Inman got a feeling like an itch at the back of his head. He paused and looked around. There was a figure in the distance behind him, a man walking fast. Inman finished the potato and stepped out briskly until he came to the first bend in the road. Once he was around it, he went into the woods and took up a good watching position behind a downed tree trunk. Shortly the walker came around the bend. He went hatless and wore a long gray coat with flapping skirts and carried a lumpish leather knapsack and a walking staff as tall as he was. He strode along, head down, marking his pace with the staff like some mendicant friar from days of yore. As the man drew nearer, it became plain that his face was cut and marked by bruises fading to yellow and green. A split lip was part healed with a dark scab so that he looked like a hare lip. Tufts of patchy blonde fuzz grew from his white scalp, which was marked here and there by long scabs. So fine was he through the stomach that the top of his breeches lapped over like great pleats, and was tied with a length of rope. When the walker lifted his blue eyes from looking down at the road beneath his feet, Inman saw immediately that underneath all the damage, it was the preacher. Inman raised up from behind the log and said, "Hey there." The preacher stopped and stared. "Good God," he said, "just the man I was looking for." Inman pulled out his knife and held it point down, his arm relaxed. He said, "You come to me looking for vengeance. I won't even waste a cartridge. I'll lay you open right here." "Oh, no, I mean to thank you. You saved me from mortal sin." "You walked all this way just in hope of saying that?" Inman said. "No, I'm traveling, a pilgrim like yourself, though maybe I speak too soon, for all who wander are not pilgrims. At any rate, where are you headed?" Inman looked the preacher over. "What happened to your face?" he said. "When I was found, as you left me, and when the note was read, a number of the men of the congregation, led by our Deacon Johnson, stripped me and gave me a fair beating. They threw my clothes in the river and cut my hair off with their knives, I think in bafflement over some part of the story of Samson and Delilah. Then they refused even to give me an hour to draw my things together. They held me from behind, and the woman I was to marry came and spit at me and thanked the Almighty that she was not to become a Veezy. I had nothing but my 2 hands to cover my prides with, and I was told to get out of town or they'd hang me naked from the church steeple. It was just as well I couldn't have lived on there anyway." "Yes, I imagine not," Inman said. "What about the other woman?" "Oh, Laura Foster," Veezy said. "They hauled her out to tell what she knew, but she could still hardly put 2 thoughts together. When it becomes clear what state of motherhood she is in, she will be churched for a time, a year, say, and then she'll be but a subject of gossip. In 2 or 3 years more, she'll take for husband some old bachelor, willing to raise a bastard just as long as a fine-looking woman comes with the deal. She'll wind up all the better for our relations, and for me having set my mind on putting both her and my betrothed behind me." "It's still a cloudy matter to me if I did the right thing letting you live," Inman said. Without a further word, he sheathed his knife and returned to the roadway and made to continue his journey, but the preacher fell in beside him. "Since you appear to be going west, I'll just walk on with you if you don't mind," he said. "Thing is, I do," Inman said, thinking it better to go alone than with a fool for comrade. He made a motion as if to backhand the preacher, but the man did not run or fight or even try to raise his staff to parry. Rather, he hunched his shoulders to take the blow like a cowed dog, and so Inman pulled up and did not strike. He reasoned that lacking the will to drive the man off, he'd just walk on and see what came about. Veezy drifted along at Inman's elbow, talking seamlessly. He worked under the notion that he had acquired a cohort, His ambition seemed to be to disburden himself of every feature of his prior life by passing it along to Inman. Every misstep he had made, and it was clear he'd made plenty, he sought to share. He was a sorry preacher, that was a